Hey everybody, I'm Jason Tondo, and I am a developer on the Starfinder RPG for Paizo. As I record this, I am just finishing the final development stages on the Fly Free or Die adventure path, the first volume of which came out this month, November of 2020. So I'm in a mood to reflect on the whole development process of this adventure path. And I decided to record a series of developer diaries where we're going to walk through every one of these modules, every one of these adventures, and talk about how it got developed, the lessons I learned along the way, what worked, maybe what didn't work as well as I'd wanted it to or hoped it would, and how I learned from that whole process. It's kind of a combination of director's commentary. You'll hear a lot from me about sources and inspiration, parts of it that I really think are awesome, stories about how it got made, a little bit of behind the scenes stuff, kind of a peek behind the curtain. How does the sausage get made, right? A lot of people who play these games, it's very easy for us to make assumptions about how role-playing games get made. I did it. I was a, you know, third-party writer, sort of independent game maker for a long time, and I thought that I understood how these games get made. I had no idea. I had no idea. Now I've been in the job for a couple of years now, you know, and I've learned a lot about how these things actually get made in the office behind the scenes. And my hope is that there'll also will be a lot of how-to in here. You know, some of you might want to do this. You might want to make your own role-playing games. You might want to write third-party materials for somebody else's game. You might want to publish it yourself. Or maybe your goal is a full-time occupation, that you want to make role-playing games your career. So my thought is, since I'm kind of an educator at heart, I'm a recovering academic, that I would kind of walk us through all of this. And it's not, some of it's for you, but some of it's for me, because I'm in a mood where I need to kind of reflect and think about all of this and work my way through it. And I am what they used to call an audio learner, which means that I learn by hearing it and talking about it, that I process this stuff by talking about it. So we're going to talk about it together. If you have questions, you'd like particular thing you would like to see about, you'd like to see us address on this series, I don't expect many questions while I'm actually recording the show, but I would love to get your questions in the meantime. You can respond to comments here on the YouTube video, but you can also text me on Twitter at Dr. Comics, all one word, DrComics, at Dr. Comics, and just, you know, shout out to me and let me know what you would like to see, and I'll address those questions and those thoughts as we work our way through. Let's briefly address what you're in for here. I'm thinking this is going to be about a 6 to 8 episode series. I'm going to need 6 episodes just to go through all of the volumes one at a time. And then we're going to talk about the stuff before the volumes, everything, this episode, we'll get to that in a minute, what we're going to call the early phase. And then everything after the last adventure is developed, after the, and you'd be surprised how much work there still is to do, even after the last manuscript has been turned in. I'm looking at notes here. I've got my notes so I don't get lost. Okay. So let's start off with how this thing kind of happened and what the procedure is. What's the process? Now, some of you, if you've heard me talk about Fly Free or Die or other Starfinder products in other interviews, some of this might be a repeat to you. And for that, I can only apologize. But not everybody's heard all that stuff. So I kind of want to walk. This is kind of my authoritative, definitive take on everything. So I kind of want to get it all in. I was hired as a Starfinder developer at Gen Con of 2019. It had actually happened just a few weeks before then, but we held off saying anything about it until Gen Con. I didn't do any work on the game right away. As soon as I started, I came back from Gen Con, and I promptly went on a two-week vacation. But even before I left, Rob McCreary, the creative director, came to me, and he said, listen, start thinking about your first adventure path. The way that it works in Paizo is we have two people on the adventure path team, myself and Jason Keeley, my partner. And we basically trade off all the work back and forth on the adventure paths. And we divide that with the adventure and the back matter. Now, for those of you that are familiar with how adventure paths work, we're looking at about a 64-page product, okay? And about the first 36 pages of that is the adventure. And then the rest is a couple of articles, maybe 8 pages apiece, and then an alien archive section with about 8 monsters in it. And I'm going to call these things monsters for the rest of my life, even though in Starfinder, technically, they're not monsters. They're aliens. But once a DM, always a DM. They're monsters. Anyway. And then there's also a starship that goes on the inside front and back cover. It's got a stat block on one inside front cover and a map on the inside back cover. And then we have this thing called a Codex of Worlds, which is a one-page entry that describes a planet, a world of some kind, somewhere in the Starfinder universe. And it's basically a plot hook setting. And sometimes different pieces of this product will be related to the adventure, not necessarily, but sometimes. So, for example, a couple of the creatures in the Alien Archives section might be monsters that first show up in the adventure that you're reading. But the others won't be. The Codex of Worlds might be a planet or a space station or something that you go to in the adventure, but it might not be. It might be something different. The starship, usually something that factors into the adventure, but not always. And the articles, we tend at the time, a lot of this is changing, but at the time, we thought of those articles as kind of one that's sort of player-facing. Player character creation rules options, for example, or gear that player characters would buy, feats, that kind of thing, player stuff. And the other would be more GM facing, maybe a lore article, a write-up on a deity, or something like that, corporations of the galaxy, whatever, like background information on the setting. Maybe a gazetteer of an important location that the players go to in the adventure. All right, so Rob, so Keeley and I bet we trade back and forth, but when I came in, I had come in while in kind of an unusual time because there had been two openings on the team. Owen had just left and Chris Sims had just left. Now, the important person in this equation is Chris Sims, because Sims had been Keeley's partner on the adventure path. And the adventure path that they were currently on, which was a threefold conspiracy, had been Sims's idea. So he was the lead developer on that project. And what that meant is that he developed the adventures and any of the back matter stuff that was part of the adventure. Like if there were those aliens that showed up in the alien archive, which were part of the adventure material, he would develop that as well. If the Codex of Worlds was tied in, he would develop that. If the starship was part of the adventure, he would develop that. Everything else would get developed by Keeley. They would do that for 6 volumes, in theory. Meanwhile, at the same time, Keeley is working on the next adventure path, which was the Devastation arc, our first high-level AP. And he would have traded, and then Sims would have done the back matter in those. Well, except that Sims left halfway through 3-4 Conspiracy, less than halfway through, in fact. So Keeley had to take over pretty much with volume 4. I think Sims got hired as a contract, as a freelance developer, to develop volume 3, which I couldn't develop because I'd written it. Never develop your own work. Like, one of the things that we all understand is, for those of us that work in this occupation, is that the more hand, I don't want to say too many authoritative statements here, but you shouldn't edit your own work because you can't see your own flaws, you can't see your own mistakes, and you shouldn't develop your own work because development is essentially power editing. Okay. Development is editing when you don't have to ask permission. If you see something that you want to change, you just change it. And you can do that as much or as little as you want. There's a lot more to the difference of those two jobs, and we will totally get to that. And that's a very good time for me to bring up something. Okay. Well, maybe we won't get to it yet, but we'll get to it soon. I want to note that the editorial department had their own project lead on this, a sort of liaison between the development team and the editorial team. And for Fly Free or Die, that person was Kieran Newton. And Kieran has been an invaluable help in this entire process. And I really want them to talk about what they've done and why they believed in this project and how they helped make it a better version of itself, because that is absolutely what Kieran did. And we will get, as we work through this, you'll see Kieran's involvement in specific ways that we'll pull out when we get to those sections of the adventure. But Kieran wasn't involved yet. So I had done, now it's my turn. So Keeley had developed the Devastation arc and the back half of Threefold Conspiracy. And so it was my turn, quite frankly. It was my turn. And so I would be coming up with the first event, with my first adventure path, like literally weeks into the job. Okay. Well, I knew this was happening and I had 2-week vacation. So I drove the entire West Coast. I started up at Port Flattery, which is this tiny little pinprick in the northwestern corner of Washington. And where you can whale watch and hike the Native American reservation. And then you drive all the way south along the coast as long as you can until you hit Mexico. Or in my case, I hit San Diego, and that's when I stopped. And I spent about 2 weeks doing it, and that gave me a lot of time. I had a lot of time to think and a lot of time to kind of just, you know, brainstorm and not be pressured, which was really great. So I took my vacation and I came back, and pretty soon, within a week, Rob was like, okay, well, we're going to have a pitch meeting. And okay, well, what does that mean? Like, I've never been in these meetings. I have never even attended one of these meetings before. And now I have to pitch a project at one of them. Well, there's only 3 people on the Adventure Path team. There's Rob, Keeley, and me. That's it. We make all the decisions about the adventures, pretty much. We have to get approvals eventually from Eric. But by the time it gets to Eric, it should be good. So I started brainstorming potential ideas about what the adventure path would be about. And we have a list of these things already. We literally have a page of like unused adventure path ideas, and it's filled with stuff like the Junk Lords of Akaton and the Stewards AP, or, you know, whatever. And some of these are just a very brief concept. Some of them are just a title. Skulls and Shackles in Space, you know. Okay. I don't think I used any of them. Because, of course, I wanted to do my own thing, right? Once a DM, always a DM. So I started thinking about what it might be and what I might want to do. And I had a few ideas. I came into that meeting with 3 ideas. Now, I didn't know what these pitch meetings were supposed to be. Until that point, the pitch meeting had been basically 3 guys, Sims, Keeley, and Rob, sitting in a room throwing ideas around until they agree on something, and then the developer goes back and writes an outline. I didn't do it that way. I went in with 2 pages of typed up notes, which I handed out to everybody with my 3 ideas on them. I think I overprepared. I think that by going in with some ideas already in paragraph. And I kind of like blocked out like what the six volumes would be in each one of these pitches. Like, okay, volume one, this happens. Volume two, this thing. Volumes one, four, five, and six are about this other thing. Like, you know, like you can kind of really block it out. I did too much planning. And what that made it feel like is it kind of put the other people in the room on the defensive. Like they felt like, well, does that mean we can't throw out ideas because he's already got these things figured out? Like, are we, they want to be part of the process. Let's talk about the creative director position for a minute. The creative director on a role-playing game sounds like an incredibly fun, prestigious job. You're the director of creativity. Like you decide where the game goes. What is the game going to be? You have final say in a lot of ways. Yes. But you have first say in almost nothing. The creative director doesn't write adventures. The creative director does not write books. The creative director deals with budgets and spreadsheets. The creative director has to approve things, but the creative director doesn't get to write, outline, or pitch things. But the creative director wants to feel involved in the game. They want to feel like they are more than just a yes or a no person, because either one of those jobs is kind of thankless. They want to be involved in the creative process. So I have to give them opportunities to be that if I want to be successful. When it's just me, when I'm just writing, you know, a 250-page King Arthur game, I can just do it the way I want to do it. And if I want to sit back and figure everything out, I can just figure it out. There's nobody that I have to get approval on. There's nobody that has to buy in. But now I'm part of a company and I'm part of the team, and the team has to buy in. And that means I have to give them on-ramps to buy in. And the pitch meeting is part of that on-ramp. You have to build these opportunities where other members of the team can feel like they own something of it. They're part of it. It's not just something that Tondro has made. He's making all the rest of us execute it. That's not a successful approach for me, at least. You got to have other people have bought in. Okay, so anyway, back to the pitch meeting. So the ideas, let's start with the one that got approved. So I had three, and Fly Free or Die came about because my second role-playing game ever was Traveler. And Traveler had this fantastic simulationist aspect to it where you would travel from planet to planet and you could carry cargo, and there would be planets that had low tech but high resources, and other planets with low resources and high tech, and you would buy stuff you would buy robots at one and sell them for grain at the other, and you would make a fortune. Other more modern current role-playing games also do this. I played plenty of GURPS in that sort of second phase of RPGs, right? Where past travel, if you think of Traveler, D&D is kind of the first wave, and then you've got that kind of middle wave. And GURPS is part of that. And GURPS also had these endless tables, right, of like cargo and how much you could sell it for, and the money, the financial aspects of space travel was like a mini game. And I would spend a lot of hours playing that mini game, and I enjoyed it. It was fun. And there seemed to me to be a lot of popular culture touchstones for it, Firefly Serenity being a great contemporary example. Now, Firefly and Serenity are old enough now that there's a whole wave of science fiction gamer people who think of it as old. But it was pretty dynamic television. And even now, when I look at TV trying to recapture that magic of Firefly, you know, you can tell which shows are trying to grab that market. So you've got this sort of rough and tumble, shady gang of player characters who aren't trying to save the galaxy. This is very important, and it was a very hard sell for this aspect of the game, of the adventure path, because it's heroic, but pretends that it's not. It's not a big world-threatening menace like our adventure paths often are. Threefold Conspiracy's got this huge Pact World's political conspiracy going on. Dawn of Flame ends in an invasion of the Burning Archipelago by an Efreet navy from the Plane of Fire, for Christ's sakes. We've got planet-destroying death weapons. Fly, Fear, Die was not going to have any of that. And that makes it sound like a sad trombone noise when you're in the pitch room, right? But you have to try to convey the fact that it's about ordinary people. What's the Star Wars game? Fantasy Flight put out four different Star Wars games. Which one was the most popular? Which one did they do first? The Han Solo one, of course, because that's the most fun when you're playing smugglers and bounty hunters, when you're Chewie, you know, just trying to fly the Millennium Falcon from planet to planet. Yeah. Jedis are fun. Military stuff is fun, but Edge of Empires is where it's at. Aliens. Like, the characters of Alien are space truckers. The heroes of Aliens are these Marines, right? But they're being ground under the foot of this sociopathic company. And from the very beginning, I had this idea that the Fly, Fear, Die, which didn't have that name at the time, by the way. I think I was calling it Free Traders or something. And we'll get to naming in a minute. That it was going to have an evil company in it, a mega corporation that, now why am I doing this? Why am I creating a new mega corporation that's evil? Well, there's a couple of reasons. For one thing, we didn't really have a good candidate for that in Starfinder already. Now, we have a lot of corporations. In my opinion, we have too many. I don't really find most of them particularly all that interesting or useful. But the one company that really gets any kind of screen time in the core rulebook is the Aspis Consortium, which is clearly supposed to be an evil corporation. But the Aspis Consortium has got the shit kicked out of it for 10 years in Pathfinder. Like, they're a bunch of losers. Now, I realize that in Starfinder, this is a different company. It doesn't have the same role. The Aspis Consortium is the Pathfinder Society's nemesis in Pathfinder. They're not the Starfinder Society's nemesis. They have a completely different narrative role. But they have that stink to me of somebody who's just gotten their asses handed to them for the entirety of Pathfinder First Edition. And quite frankly, I don't find them very interesting. Now, this is a challenge to rehabilitate the Aspis Consortium and make them interesting. Okay, it's easy to say, well, I don't like them, so I don't want to use them. It's harder to say, okay, well, then do something about it. Right? Put some action behind your cake hole. Well, I will, but not in this adventure path, not in Fly, Fear, Die. Secondly, things in the core rulebook are hard to mess with. I can't just, like, if I wasn't going to have an evil corporation, I can't do whatever I want to them if they're the Aspis Consortium. The only way to make sure that I have an organization that I can do whatever I want is to make them new and unique to this AP. Keeley phrases this as, we got to create the thing in volume one so we can blow it up in volume six. It's a little predictable, it's a little formula, but there's a reason why we do it that way. And that's because we can't just make changes to the setting in the core rulebook. People at ranks higher than me have decided that everything in the core rulebook has to always be true. We don't want somebody to go buy the core rule book and then find out that, oh, well, actually, like, Saren Rae's dead now. She died in Adventure Path 28. What? So the book they bought is now no longer accurate. It's been outdated. They don't want that to happen. So everything in the core rule book has to remain true. Well, that ties my hands a little bit. I can't really do stuff. Like, I can't have the swarm invade the Pact Worlds. We have to create a new planet. We have to create Suskalon. I'm talking about the Attack of the Swarm AP. So that we can do whatever we want to the Suskalon system. Because we can't do anything we want to the Pact World system. It's kind of, because it's in the core rule book, it's sort of taped off. For better or for worse. So I wanted to have a new an antagonist that would be this evil company. I didn't have a name for it yet. It was just the company. I knew I wanted to have a crime boss, my job of the hut, if you will. And I think I picked Drow pretty early. This would be an unusually hard sell. Rob, our creative director, is not a fan of the legacy species being in Starfinder. There's a very good reason for this. Like, although we often describe Starfinder as Pathfinder in space, we also talk about it internally as something that we want to use our own toys and not Pathfinder's. We want to make Starfinder its own identity with its own cool stuff. It's got its own cool species. We don't need to have elves and dwarves and halflings and gnomes running around in Starfinder, because we've got 100 other playable races that you can play. You're absolutely right. We do. But Drow are perfect. their society on Apostate and everything. But I think Rob did suggest that we hook them into the Golden League. And you know, Rob just knows the setting better. He knows the lore. So when I say it's a crime organization, like, well, what kind of crime organization? So he's the one that's just the Golden League, and I'm glad that he did, because it worked very well. And it reinforces this gold theme that goes throughout the adventure path that we'll get to in a minute. So I pitched Fly, Fear, Die as one of three ideas. I think my second idea was this idea that I had for a Kasatha storyline. I love the Kasathans. I love Salarians. They're one of my favorite aspects of the setting. I came up with this idea, which I privately referred to as my new Krypton plotline, which is the player characters would travel to the original Kasathan homeworld, which is about to be destroyed or blown up by the sun or whatever. And they would sort of participate in rescuing the people that the Kasathans that are still there. And it would be kind of like my Krypton plot line. I think there was some feeling like that would be hard to sustain over a 6-volume AP. Fair. Might make a great module. Or a shorter 3-volume AP. We threw around some other ideas. At one point, for example, a Stewards AP. I'm a big Star Trek nerd. If you watch this channel, you know that I do the Space Force Star Trek analysis show with my colleagues, Jim Seals and Aid Smith. And the Stewards are the closest that we have in Starfleet, in the Starfinder setting. So I pitched that as well. We threw around a few other ideas. At one point, I described Fly, Fear, Die as Skull and Shackles in space. Now, for those of you that are old Pathfinder fans, Skull and Shackles is a famous adventure path for Pathfinder First Edition in which the player characters are all pirates. I think I was trying to pitch it like this because I wanted it to have a catchy subtitle. Like, oh, okay, that's what it is. It's Skull and Shackles in space. Except that this isn't actually Skull and Shackles in space at all. It might look like it on the surface because you're sort of shady smugglers or bounty hunters, you know. But Skull and Shackles was an AP that kind of endorsed being evil cutthroats. And this came up in the early meetings about this adventure path because the question was, well, what alignment is this adventure path for? Like, is it for evil characters? And I didn't want that. If you look at the source material, whether it's Aliens or Firefly or Han Solo, those characters are all good, right? And I just got finished reading the first Expanse novel. Employment tip, always read your boss's favorite book. Rob is a big fan of The Expanse. And so I read the first book right before I made this pitch. But anyway, no, it's not for evil characters. Now, I assume that the characters will probably mostly be neutral, but it needs to be open. In fact, it needs to even encourage good characters. Let's talk about Malcolm Reynolds for a minute. The protagonist of the Firefly series. Malcolm Reynolds pretends to be neutral. I do the job and I get paid. That's a neutral creed. And he says it constantly, right? Every opportunity he gets. And he keeps insisting that all he really wants is to be left alone. He just wants to do his thing, right? You can't take the sky from me, that whole business. Okay, that's full of shit. Because whenever Malcolm is in a difficult position where he's forced to choose between doing what is right and doing what is easy, he always chooses what is right, unless he makes a mistake, picks what is easy, and then he regrets it later, right? And he tries to go back and fix it, or he has to live with the ramifications of his mistake. So the protagonists of Fly Free or Die work best when you've got at least one character on the team whose moral compass points true north. Malcolm Reynolds is a character who pretends to be lawful neutral, but he's really chaotic good, right? Okay. So I pitched these three ideas. And we talked about it for about an hour, and maybe more. And Rob, finally, to his credit, he said, listen, which one of these do you really want to do? Oh, there was one more. I pitched a Kingmaker in Space idea. That was my third one. Now, those of you that are watching Paizo, you already know that we've announced already Horizons of the Vast, which is Jason Keeley's the lead developer on that. I'll be doing the back matter, assisting him on that. And that kind of is our Kingmaker in Space AP. I don't want to get too much into this because I've talked about it elsewhere, but we all knew, everybody in the Starfinder team knew that Kingmaker in Space was something the fans wanted. The suits wanted it because Kingmaker was a very successful enterprise on computer, on PC and so on. But there are unique complications to doing Kingmaker in Starfinder because it's essentially colonialism. Like, you're going to go to another planet where people already live and you're going to colonize it. You're going to take it over and run it better than the locals. So what do you, in Kingmaker, you can go into the wilderness and you can kill all the orcs and take over the land. Well, maybe you can get away with it, maybe in 10 years ago. But you can't get away with that shit now, and we didn't even want to try. It was wrong. We don't want you going to a planet, killing everybody you meet, and taking over. So instead, so we all pitched different ideas. We all came up with different ways on how we wanted to do this. And we had everybody had their own idea. John Compton had his idea. Joe Pacini had his idea. And I came up with one, and I pitched it. It was my third proposal. But eventually Rob said, well, listen, which of these ideas do you really want to do? And I said that one, the free traders one. And he was like, I thought so. Okay, so let's go with that one. And so he let me do it because he knew that I really wanted to. Sometimes the creative director can be in a position where he feels like he's the guy that's saying no to everything. And it can create a lot of tension on the team, like, you know, the person is seen as just constantly being a roadblock. It's a tough job. I don't envy that job. I don't want to be creative director for a game. I have too much fun actually creating. But at the same time, you know, as this job is tough, we acknowledge difficulties. Rob came through and let me do the stuff. He could tell when something was really important to me. And then we found a way to make it work. So then, once the idea has been approved, once we have an idea, now I'm going to go back and write the outline. Now, this was a long process for Fly, Free, or Die. My impression is that it threw me like about a one-week deal, a two-week deal. My dogs are going crazy in the background. Please forgive me. But I had to go a few times around the outline because I'd never written one before. And I, quite frankly, I think that Rob was not entirely on board with the concept of the adventure path. When I described it as a setting, as an adventure path, and this was in the pitch, where the player characters had a lot of decisions to make about how they wanted to do things. Like, are they going to befriend this character or are they going to stab in the back? Like, and I wanted ramifications to come down the road. So somebody that you meet or backstab in volume two comes back in volume five, right? And I wanted to have this crew of rivals, a rival starship crew that the player characters would interact with. And how the player characters behaved determined how that rival crew would behave, because the rival crew looks to the player characters as models for behavior. And if the player characters are good, if they sacrifice their own needs to help other people without reward, this is important, because if you're doing it to get paid, it's not good, right? You're getting something out of it. Are you willing to put yourself in the line when there is no reward? Or do you treat people as just ATM machines? Are they just there to pop out credits when you do the right, when you do X, Y, and Z? Or are you just there to stab them in the back and take the money, whether they give it to you or not? So I wanted this rival crew, the crew of the Wintermourne, as they eventually turned into, thanks to Leo Glass, and we'll get to that in a few episodes. The crew of the Wintermourne, the rival crews, they were just called for a long time. They were just the rival crew. The rival crew become allies or enemies based on the behavior of the player characters. This stuff is hard to do in Adventure Path because you've got six different writers, each working on their own little slice. The person who's writing volume two, where the rival crew is introduced, is not the same person as the person writing volume five, where the rival crew make their final turn to evil or to good. How do you coordinate that shit? Well, you got to have all the manuscripts in front of you, and it's hard. If somebody's late or things don't get done on time, you know, or it just takes a long time to develop stuff, right? Or, you know, if people don't communicate properly. And then that's just this one rival crew thing. I'm trying to do this the whole adventure path, all kinds of stuff that connects across from volume to volume. Look at something like Dawn of Flame. Dawn of Flame is fairly self-contained. Walt's joined. Thank you, Walt. Yeah. Walt, the samurai would only do anything if they were well paid. The concept of Bushido was later developed to make them seem romantic. The samurai money equated to work. Honor came later. Well, fair enough. I guess that's a good way of saying that I'm not dealing with that kind of honor system, right? Or at least you could. You can be that kind of character, Black or Die. You could be the neutral person who's just doing stuff to get paid. Or you can be, guys, you're embarrassing me in front of the crowd. Or you could be the good character who's willing to sacrifice your own values. Anyway, thanks, Walt, for chiming in. Walt Rebellion, your old friend. So because there's all of these different plot lines that cross between all the adventure paths, that made it very hard to develop. And Rob knew it would be hard to develop, and he warned me it would be hard. Walt, you're back again. See, I was looking at how many people were watching, and I saw one, and now I know it's you. Yes. Hopefully my dogs will stop embarrassing me. So he warned me. He said he described this adventure path as ambitious, by which he meant, Tondro, you might be biting off more than you could chew. But of course, I'm young and overconfident, and I was like, I can do it, right? And I really wanted to do it, and I eventually did. It took a long time to get there. Right. So then after the pitch, I write the outline. The outline went through multiple approval phases because the outline in this case was about 6 or 8 pages of actual plot. It was basically a long, well, more than that. Okay. Ultimately, the outline is turned into about a 20 page document. And in which it's got a bunch of preamble, information for all of the authors, like what is Paizo looking for, the Starfinder style guide, things like that. I wrote an introduction about the themes of the adventure path, and in which, for example, I cited a lot of the inspiration. You've already heard me talk about Traveler, Firefly, Aliens, Eve Online, where you do a lot of buying and selling, right? And it's all about kind of the, you know, the corporate nature of the universe. That's also where, for example, I first described this whole adventure path as essentially a James Cameron movie. If you look at James Cameron movies, and I'm not just talking about Aliens, I'm talking about all of them, like Avatar, Aliens, Terminator, even Titanic. Like, they all have this class issue where the protagonist is basically poor, and they're surrounded by rich people, or they encounter rich people who are like they're like aliens from another planet. Like, they don't even speak the same language. They've got nothing in common. And the alienation between the working class people and the blue bloods is a huge source of tension in these movies. And whether that person is Burke Carter J from Aliens, I can't even remember his name, the guy from Avatar, whose last name has the word self in it because he's selfish, right? Or Billy Zane's rich husband material, you know, prospective husband to be of Titanic. There's a reason why the protagonists of Terminator and Terminator 2 are both poor, because those are the characters that we identify with. Like, that's us, right? That's us. We have a hard time with Hamlet these days because neither you nor I are a prince of Denmark. Like, it's hard for us to get into that character, you know? Like, it's pretty remote. But if you make that Prince of Denmark like somebody who just has to, you know, just walks around the street in a hoodie, okay, now I can kind of start to get it, right? And that's what these movies all do. Walt says we should develop an adventure path called Titanic, Alien, Avatar, Terminator. You know, you want, okay, I think I just wrote it. I think I just did that, AP, dude. All right, So I wrote that in the introduction, sort of telling people kind of what the themes of the adventure path were about. Like, this is about working class characters, and they're not going to save the galaxy. This is not that story. This is the story about ordinary people who are just trying to get by. And if that sounds political, it is. Like, I wrote this knowing that, looking at the world around us, right, where people are having a really hard time. Like, it's really hard to get along in the world today. You know, like, my dad was a union job guy. Like, he worked in a sheet metal shop my whole life, you know, my whole childhood and young adulthood until he retired. He worked with his hands, and it was a good union job, and it paid good money. And my stepmother worked in human resources. You know, my mom was a secretary. My stepfather, a construction site manager, you know, I mean, this, and now I'm a recovering academic, you know, I'm like the one that they sent off to college, but this is kind of the family I grew up in, and those jobs are hard to find anymore. And most of us are just living paycheck to paycheck. We think of ourselves as middle class, but that's not middle class. Most Americans are like one health crisis away from asking their family for money or starting a GoFundMe. That's not middle class. That's working class. If you are living paycheck to paycheck and working on your budget every month to make sure you hit your bills, that is working class. And I wanted to tell a story about working class people with working class problems. Now, there's challenges to that in an adventure path where characters start off at level one and they're level 13 by the end and they've got more money than, you know, God. When you've got a 10,000 GP laser pistol on your hip, how do you possibly get off being poor? This is a serious challenge. I thought about how I wanted the adventure path arc to go. And from very early on, in fact, I think it was part of my first pitch, I had this four-part concept of rags to riches, to ruin, to revenge. Now, those of you that are old D&D players, you'll remember the A series. And I think it's in A4, where the players wake up in like a prison and they've got nothing. They have like a broken knife and their underwear. And that's basically all they have. They don't have any of their stuff. And they have to survive, get through the adventure with nothing. And I wanted to borrow that. So I wanted the players to go. So rags to riches is the classic AP, right? Like level one to level 12, and you just get better, better and better and better all the way. Well, that's not this AP. You get better and better all the way from one through four. And then, well, you're breaking my concentration, buddy. He writes, I'd be a prince with a broken knife. I wouldn't even need the underwear. Well, listen, your personal peccadillos are on you. I'm giving a shit. I should really not make these recordings public until I'm done recording them. There goes the neighborhood. I'm just kidding, Walt. You could crash my party anytime. All right. Now where the hell was I? Oh yeah. So volumes one through four are the players getting super rich, right? Like they start off poor, working class. Okay, levels one, level three, level four, you're level five, all that up through about level six or so, maybe level five, you can get away with it feeling like a working class adventure where you're just struggling to get by. But once you start hitting like level six, level seven, you sort of feel like you've gone out of that theme anymore. You're not working class anymore. So instead, that's where the players get a big heist. They get a big job that makes them fabulously wealthy. And then in volume five, they lose everything. There's a Firefly comic that portrays, I think it's a short, like three or four issue limited series, that portrays the crew of the ship at a time when they have, that when they're fabulously rich, when like everything has gone right. And it's all those episodes that we never got to see on the show. I was kind of riffing off of that a little bit. Let's give the players an opportunity to be fabulously rich and then take it all away from them and ruin them. And then it becomes a revenge story where they're going to get revenge on the sons of bitches that took them down. From a very early phase, we came up with this idea. We latched on to the idea of the commerce barge, the Calistocracy commerce barge. Now, this is actually Rob's idea, Rob's contribution. It's mentioned very briefly in the Pact Worlds book. There is this space station called the Horse Eye Orbital Plate. Thurston invented it because he wrote the Avalon chapter for Pact Worlds. And it's mentioned very casually that every month this golden plated commerce barge sets out from the Horse Eye Orbital Plate, and it's owned by the Calistoc, the prophets of Calistrade. This is a Pathfinder Galarian religion / philosophy. And Rob had this idea that the commerce barge sort of sounds like the treasure fleet. And if you think of piracy, we're talking about the great Spanish treasure fleet. that would gather up gold in the Caribbean, and then once every few months would sail back to Spain and loaded with gold. Well, that made it a prime target for piracy. And there's a lot of stories that you can tell about the hunt for the treasure fleet. So he thought, well, this sounds kind of like a treasure fleet. It sounds like a great big super lucrative object that the players can rob. Well, I thought that too. and that's what I wrote. And as we get to volume four, you'll see that we sort of figured out it wasn't as easy as I thought. But that was the initial idea. I was not wild on using the Calistocracy, the prophecy of Calistrade, in Fly Free or Die. An earlier Starfinder volume had written up the prophecies of Calistrade in a Cults of the Galaxy article. And the author of that article had described them as basically kind of a Scientology riff in space. It was a scam. It's a scam designed to soak a lot of money out. It's a pyramid scheme. And the people at the top of the pyramid collect lots of money. And the people at the bottom of the pyramid are suckers. I didn't find that very interesting, frankly. And I didn't really get the appeal of the prophecies of Calistrade. And to some degree, I still don't. But as we worked on it, I came to understand that the prophets of Calistrade, the Callistocrats, and that is a great name, by the way. Like, I will use that name at any opportunity. The Callistocrats basically worship money. And when I'm doing an adventure path about working class characters, they're great villains. Like, are there any better villains than the people who are willing to do anything to get money because then they don't have to live with the ramifications? In our setting, Starfinder, if you're evil, if you are evil to get money, well, you get judged by Pharasma and you go to the lawful evil plane or whatever. You go to hell. But if you're a Callistocrat, you can get out of that. You can take it with you. You die, you get all this money, and then you never get judged. And so you're able to avoid the ramifications for all of your evil acts. Well, pretty big on the ramifications. I want you to have to pay the consequences for the shit you do. So in that sense, the prophecies of the Callistocracy were great antagonists that I was initially very leery on, but it was, I don't know whether it was Keeley or Rob, but it worked. It worked. And I was very skeptical of it, but it worked. Okay, so at this point, I would write the outline and I would submit it, and then Rob would make changes or he'd have concerns. And he never really made changes. He was always like, well, but you can't do this because of this canonical thing, or this seems weak, or this adventure, you know, this part of the plot seems like it's a little thin, like the plot doesn't make any sense here. And he would interrogate the manuscript, and my job was to brainstorm solutions and get it into a situation that he could approve it. Then it goes to Eric for approval. Adventure Paths are Paizo's flagship product line, the Pathfinder Adventure Path, more so than the Starfinder Adventure Path. But still, Paizo is Paizo. Paizo is the company it is today because of Adventure Paths. We support our games with extensive adventures. There are a lot of science fiction games out there. How many of them have 30 adventures for them? That's a much smaller piece of the pie. And that's not even counting all the organized play adventures and everything else. I mean, we're just talking, we've got many years worth of content for Starfinder. And the adventure path is a big deal. It has to get approved not only by Eric, but also by not only by Rob, but also by Eric Mona, the publisher. In order to get to that point, it had to have a name. We couldn't just call it Free Traders, okay? It's got to have a Paizo. The people at Paizo, people like Rob and Eric and Keeley, put a lot of stock in what something gets named. They're very invested in naming things. And naming these products are very important to them. They often feel like the naming makes or breaks a game's sales. Remember, we are at a corporation here. We're here to, I'm not just writing this thing on my own for, you know, the 100 people that'll buy it on DriveThruRPG. I'm writing this for a company that has to collect that money to pay everybody's salary. It's a money-making enterprise, and it can't just be a good game. It also has to sell. Paizo's roots are often in that sort of pulp literature, and a lot of the best names are sort of punchy action names. Those are the names that that Eric and Rob and Keeley often like. I am not that attached to these various names. I did write up names for all the various volumes of The Adventure Path, but I never for a minute assumed that any of them would actually be used. I let other people do the naming, at least on this Adventure Path, and that paid off. Everybody had, Keeley, when I say everybody, I mean Keeley and Rob. Keeley and Rob both threw out lots of ideas for the naming the Adventure Path as a whole or the individual volumes. I finally settled on Picked Fly, Fear, Die, which was Rob's idea, one of Rob's many suggestions. He probably had about 6 or 8 of them for the title of the whole AP. I remember when I was in one of our Monday stand-up meetings. Paizo has a Monday meeting where we all just sort of go around the room and talk about what we're doing. And I remember we were still in the office at that time. There was long before the virus, right? This is like October of 2019. I can't even remember. It's so long ago now. 2019. And I said, we've settled on Adventure Path that we're calling Fly Free or Die. And when I said that the name was Fly Free or Die, Rob, the creative director, went, yes. Remember when I said we needed creative director buy-in? That's how I got buy-in, right? Like that showed me that Rob felt there was enough of him in this Adventure Path that he was invested in it. He wanted it to succeed. It's not just Tondro's book. It's his book too. It's his name on it, right? That's mission accomplished as far as I'm concerned. That got me the buy-in I needed to get in order for us all to be working on this thing together. Once the outline was approved, then it was my turn to hire writers to write the various chapters. Now I needed 6 authors to do that with. And I wanted it to be a diverse cast. This is very important to us in the Starfinder team. I did not want a bunch of middle-aged straight white dudes like me writing every volume of this AP. Joe Pacini had made a point of hiring an equal number of women to men when he had hired the Alien Archive 3 writers. And I thought to myself, well, there's a good goal. Let's hire at least as many women as we hire men. So I had 6 slots, right? Now, let's talk very briefly about hiring your friends. I felt incredibly guilty at the idea of hiring one of my friends to write one of these modules. Chris Sims, who I just told you, had been a developer at Starfinder. In fact, he had had my job. I was sitting in Chris Sims's chair. Well, he would kick ass on one of these adventures. Like, he would totally kill it, right? But I felt like if I hired Chris to write one of these adventures, people would think, oh, he's just hiring his friends. I shouldn't have worried about it. I later got to hire him for a bigger adventure, in many ways a more important adventure, and I'm glad. But at first, I didn't hire him to write an adventure. I hired him to write the player's guide. Now, we haven't actually got to that point yet, and we'll talk about it later on, because originally, that wasn't the intention. Originally, I hired BJ Hensley to write the first volume, and I hired BJ because, A, she does great work. She's got a long list of credits in the adventure RPG industry, and tons of people recommend her. But in addition, I knew that she was working for Lone Wolf, and Lone Wolf had just laid off virtually their entire staff. Look, if you have the opportunity to do good while also crossing your needs, your goals off the list, like if you could put a check mark next to hire an author, but also hire an author for that accomplishes something good in the universe, like that's how I sleep at night, man. Lone Wolf had totally screwed over their employees. It was a terrible situation, and I don't know how those people sleep at night. But I knew that I could do something about it. And if I hired BJ to write this adventure in October, and I gave her the first adventure, then she would get paid by Christmas, and she's got kids to feed, man. So with great confidence and enthusiasm, I signed BJ Hensley for the first volume. And then I did hire a friend. I hired Leo Glass in the editor department to write the second volume. Now, I'd worked with Leo as an editor before I came to Starfinder. And Leo, the reason why I hired Leo is because he ran the game. Like, Leo ran Starfinder every week for, like, his regular crowd, you know? And I wanted somebody that I knew the system. And also, because he was an editor, he would know how to do all that stuff, too. He would give me a manuscript that I would not need to edit as hard. It would be a lighter lift. So I hired Leo to do the second volume. Originally, I had somebody else I was going to hire to do the third volume. I can't remember who. I remember writing to them and waiting. I'd never heard anything back from them. And I think I had met them at Gen Con. They were a published author. I never heard back from them. So instead, I left the volume three blank for a minute. Then I hired Kendra Leigh Speedling, whom I had met at Gen Con and who had a long history of writing for Pathfinder and Starfinder Organized Play. I hired Kendra to write volume four. Christopher Wasco was a new author to Starfinder Adventure Paths, but he had written Organized Play stuff before. And so I hired him to write volume five. And then I hired Jessica Catalan to write volume six. So I had BJ, Kendra, and Jessica, as well as Leo, Christopher, and this third person, this volume three that I didn't know who I was going to give it to. And as I was recruiting, Joe, who was across the cubicle from me, said, like, hey, I'm looking for work. Like, I'm looking for a writing assignment if you have an adventure. Well, Joe wrote the second adventure in Dawn of Flame, and I love that adventure. Like, it's great. I remember reading it and thinking, wow, Joe really did a fantastic job on this adventure. It's got, like, the whole casino gambling thing. It's got a bunch of little mini games in it. I love that adventure. And so I said, well, if I can't get a hold of this other writer and they don't write me back, I'm gonna take you up, and then you're going to write volume three. And he was like, okay. And that's exactly how that happened. Do not underestimate the value of being in the room when these things get handed out. Now, at the same time, a lot of these authors had never written an adventure path before. BJ, Leo, Kendra, Christopher, Jessica. I think they're all brand new to adventure paths. Kendra may have done one before. I can't remember. Anyway, they'd written back matter material, or they'd written other adventures like organized play stuff, but most of them were new to adventure path writing. I knew that. I knew that that might mean I would have more development work to do, but it was worth it because I wanted to do something good. I wanted to help new people get into the industry, get into the business. And there is no more prestigious job at Paizo than writing an adventure path. It is the largest assignment we give out. Hardbacks get divvied up into tiny little slices that are maybe like 5,000 words or 1,000 words, or like you write a 500 word monster. Like, we divvy up those big books into very small pieces. But an adventure path volume, you write the whole thing. And for Starfinder, that's a 25,000 word assignment. It's larger for Pathfinder because their books are longer. And if you can do that, well, shit, you can do anything in this business. You can do anything. Okay. We will pick up next episode with We're No Heroes, because at this point I've hired everybody. I've written the outline. I send them all the outline. I give them a deadline. I need to get an outline by a particular date. I need to get a milestone by a particular date. And I need to get your turnover by a particular date. And then I sit back and I wait. Well, actually, I'm busy doing back matter on other on Threefold Conspiracy and Devastation Arc, right? But I've done everything up to the actual development of the adventures. Those come next. So we'll pick up there with Volume 1, We're No Heroes, next time. I hope you found this interesting. Once again, if you have questions or comments, post them on the video channel or hit me up directly on Twitter @DrComics.